Welcome to the Ninja Lane Podcast. In this episode, we talk about mobile devices and when is a phone more of a tablet. And we look at what games Darren has been playing and the latest Borderlands 2 expansion. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia. With me today, I have Darren McCain. For the past, I don't know how many years, I've been a loyal BlackBerry user.
I know, and that's odd, really, for a techie. So what got you into BlackBerries in the first place? Was that a work thing?
No, it wasn't necessarily a work thing. And, you know, my day job, not ninjalane.com, they have a, you know, they support the BlackBerry Enterprise server thing. So if you have a BlackBerry, you can get your work email and text messages and stuff like that. But you end up having to give them control of your phone, because that's the way the enterprise system works. So it's like it hooks into the BlackBerry world, and then the admins of that can go and say, well, we don't want this application installed on your machine, or we're going to push out a new application for you. And you lose a lot of control.
Well, is that a fair trade-off for maybe letting them pay for it, I guess?
Yeah, well, for them to pay for the phone, it's a big political thing, really. And it was one of those things where I got to the point where I didn't want work to know that I had a phone. It's like, if anyone asks, no, I don't have a cell phone. You can just call my desk or send me an email.
Ah, too much abuse.
Yes. For me, using the BlackBerry, because I was using the Pearl. And if you know anything about the BlackBerry phones, the Pearl is the small candy bar phone, which is a smartphone. It has a physical keyboard that has two letters per key. And so it's still a full QWERTY keyboard. If you want to do a Q, you have to hit the button twice. Or you can start typing the word and it will figure out what it is based off of the key combinations and what words it has in the dictionary.
Well, now the keyboard for the BlackBerries has been for many years been what people swear by.
Well, yeah, that's the bold or something like that with the full keyboard. And that was one thing that made BlackBerry like the epitome of the business phone, because you could check emails on it. You could surf the web on it. You could do anything really with it in the office without a computer. There's a Robin Williams movie where he rented an RV and took his family. I think it's called RV. There was a scene in there where he was writing a speech for, his boss, and he wrote it on his BlackBerry, and he was standing up on top of the RV trying to get it to send. And it was like a big long email. And it's like, that's something that you could do with a BlackBerry. Well, the Pearl is a smaller version of that. And I wanted a small phone. But I wanted a smartphone. I wanted to be able to check email. I wanted to be able to surf the web. Admittedly, the screen size was considerably small and somewhat limited in what you could do, but you could still check email. Admittedly, I used the phone to make calls, check email and, messages and stuff like that.
So not much of a multimedia web surfer.
No, I had a tablet, the Asus Slate that we use for recording the podcast, and I really rock a PC at home. That's, if I'm going to step away from the PC, I don't want to be online all the time. It's not necessarily a requirement of mine. I don't necessarily need to watch movies as I'm walking down the street.
Right.
For me, the phone was a mobile device. It was a phone. Well, times are changing and BlackBerry is having issues. And really, it was time for me to upgrade. I went through two Pearls. My rule of thumb was that when the battery in the phone that I got started losing its charge, it was time to upgrade. And that usually was about a year, year and a half afterwards.
So you've upgraded to the BlackBerry 10, right? That's the latest BlackBerry?
Yeah, the Z10. I was looking at that phone. The form factor was perfect. It really was, I want to say, the same form factor as an iPhone. So you could grab it, hold it in your hand, you could put it in your pocket. But again, BlackBerry was having a few financial issues, company issues, and they were really late to the market in terms of smartphones with like the touch screen. So I decided to go with the big boys and bought myself a Samsung Galaxy S4.
Oh, now that's a big change. The Galaxy S4 is a flagship and an Android phone.
Right. And it's using the Snapdragon processor, I think clocked 1.7 gigahertz, which is insane for a phone. But it's not necessarily a phone. It's more of a small tablet, I think.
So how do you like the Galaxy? As far as you know, I am a Galaxy user myself, but I am still using the S3.
Well, using BlackBerry for years, it's taken me a little while to get used to. The S4 is one of those epitome devices that we have to add more features because somebody says we need to have a really large screen or we need to have a quad-core processor. So I'm having trouble using it sometimes. Like, for instance, I'll be on the phone and I want to hang up. The screen kind of goes black while you're on the phone, but then when you move it away from your face, the screen comes back on. Well, there's a nice lag there. So it's really hard for me to, like, on my voicemail, for instance, press 7 to delete, because on my BlackBerry, I knew where the 7 was. I could just click it. I wouldn't even have to look. Now I have to pull the phone away from my face, look at it, wait for it to come back, and then press 7, and then put it back up to my ear so that I can see, you know, what's next or hear what's next.
It's interesting you say that, because that was actually the biggest obstacle I had when I moved over to a smartphone. I was so insistent that I needed a physical keyboard because that's what I was used to back from my BlackBerry days, that I had a slide-out phone or a flip-out keyboard for a couple of generations before I finally gave in and went to the on-screen keyboards that the Android systems do so well now.
Right, and that's a response of the iPhone success, because my first smartphone before I got the BlackBerry Pearl was an HTC slider that had a full keyboard on it. And it was really also the phone that gave me a big distaste to using a touchscreen as a phone device. Because as you're driving down the road, and you're not supposed to be using your phone and driving, but you know, you get a call, it's like you should be able to answer the phone and put it up to your ear and talk or put it on speaker or something like that.
Right.
Well, with this particular phone device, you couldn't see the screen. So I could almost never answer the phone unless I could find the answer button. It actually had an answer button on it, but I couldn't tell who was calling me. So it was mostly like a blind pick it up. Okay, who is this?
Sure, you just need a good Bluetooth device, right? That's the answer there.
Right, and I bought the Bluetooth device for that. The way that the Bluetooth devices work best is if you have the voice commands hooked up, right?
Yes, that's true.
I hooked up some of the voice commands, but it would always call the wrong person, so I couldn't ever trust it.
That's gotten a lot better. And again, thanks to the influence of Apple and Siri, if nothing else, we can thank Apple for driving the convenience features.
Definitely. And I want to say Android was one of the leaders in terms of voice to text. One of my friends who recommended the S4 to me was a longtime Android user. You know, we met in the LA one day and went out on my way to Taipei, and he was texting to me from his car as he was driving down the road, but he wasn't touching the keyboard. He was just talking, and it would convert his voice into text.
The Google Speech, yeah, and it is very impressive, and it gets better every year. I'm constantly amazed. In fact, if it weren't for some of the idiosyncrasies, I'd probably use the Google Voice commands for nearly everything on my phone. But I'm a bit old-fashioned. I kind of like the hunting for the icons and manually controlling things, but I don't know how much longer I can hold out on that.
Right. Now that I've ingrained myself into getting the S4 and learning the Android system, I've downloaded apps on my tablet all the time. I have a Transformer Infinity Pad.
Right.
I really like it. So I'm familiar with the Android system and how the App Store works. So it's just that I have this mobile device that I want to use as a phone, and it doesn't actually lend itself well to being used as a phone, which kind of begs the question as like, well, are they really phones anymore, or are they just kind of a small mobile device that happens to make calls?
Well, we've talked a lot about the technology convergence, but I am a little curious about your phone choice, because it seems like such a radical change to go to the S4, the flagship. Was it a question of screen real estate that got you interested in that? I mean, is it a feature decision?
I actually decided to make a blind decision. I wanted to get the most advanced device I could. In between my Pearls, I had an Atrix, Motorola Atrix.
Right.
And I think it was a bad phone or something like that, but I just hated it. It didn't download stuff very well, and LTE was in our area wasn't really good back then. I ended up giving it back and then getting the upgrade of the Pearl, which is what I really wanted. Well, in this case, I decided to make a blind leap, and I went shopping based on specs.
Oh, interesting. So that's kind of something that tends to lead people towards Apple products, though. I'm often amused because the phone system and purchasing a phone to me doesn't have a real parallel in the performance PC world, because it seems to me like when people purchase a phone, they don't really care about the specs. What they do is they go in and they buy whatever is the flagship from whatever brand they're most comfortable with.
Yeah, it's kind of the Apple mentality of like, this is the newest one, we threw away the old one.
Exactly. And in fact, I find that at least in my household, we are upgrading because we sort of feel obligated. My wife has an S2, and she is very shortly going to be moving to the S4, or gosh, by that time, maybe even the S5, because we're on a every other year upgrade cycle in our house. And I feel like, and maybe it's just me, but my phone service, which is Sprint, gives me an upgrade every 2 years. So I kind of feel like I have to upgrade every 2 years.
I think a lot of the, well, at least in the US, the carriers give you a 2 year upgrade plan where you can upgrade for free.
And that's misleading because of the whole subsidy thing. And it's refreshing to see some of the carriers moving to the non-subsidized phone packages, but it's hard to avoid the sticker shock that you get when you realize what these things cost without that crazy 2 year subsidy.
Yeah. What was it? The S4 was $350 or something like that. And then the Z10 was $10 less.
Yeah, and I think that's even not the initial price. I mean, those early adopters get hit with sometimes $499 or plus for unlocked phones.
In my case, I went after specs. My friend, who has been an Android mobile user forever, he was using the S4. What was it? At CES, he had the Galaxy Note, which was actually a really big phone. He said, oh, no, this isn't really that bad. See, I can put it in my pocket and carry it around. I can talk on it. And it's like, the Note's just really big. It's like a, you know, what, 7-inch
Yeah, it's
tablet.
A huge PDA-type phone. I mean, it kind of reminds me of the old Palm devices, the Trios and whatnot.
Right. He didn't realize how big the phone was until I had him send a text message using my Pearl.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, he's like, he's sitting there in a chair with his thumbs all together trying to type. And he's used a Pearl before because he's a big mobile user. He gave me the phone back and then grabbed his. And he's like, oh, my God, this thing's huge. And I'm like, well, see, told you, it's all in context at that point.
Well, I think the additional size would be more beneficial if the resolution was increasing at a higher rate. As a mobile device, there's a lot of talk about how much screen real estate and screen resolution is really useful.
Right, and how much do you need? I want to say that Apple has kind of helped a little bit saying, hey, we got the Retina display.
Right, right.
Which is just really a high resolution screen. I was watching 2.5 Geeks on Hot Hardware.
Nice.
And they were talking about a couple of mobile devices, namely the Galaxy S4. And they were talking about how some of the other devices that were coming out didn't have the same size screen. And they were really wishing that such and such a device had a larger screen. And I'm thinking to myself, are you saying that just because they don't match what the Galaxy does? Right. Or are you saying that because it really needs to be a larger screen because that's how you remain competitive? Or, you know, what was the reasoning behind that, basically? And then it got me thinking, it's like, I bought the S4 because it's the top of the line. It had the best specs. You know, it had the fastest processor, most memory, largest screen, the latest version of Android.
Right.
And then I started looking at some of the sites that review these mobile devices and some of the programs that they use to determine what device is the fastest, which one has the best graphics performance. And, you know, you got benchmarks like Linpack and AN3D Bench XL, GL Benchmark, Sun Spider, I believe, is a 3D benchmark. And then we have the Rightmark Browser Mark. And these are all, so to speak, cross-platform benchmarks that you can install on a mobile device. But they're purely synthetic. Yeah, aside from the Browser Mark, which is based off of some browser to determine how fast you can download a web page and how fast it will run JavaScript. If you install Chrome or you use the built-in browser or Firefox for that matter, all of those are going to have different performance metrics. So these numbers are somewhat misleading because they have no relevancy, which, you know, as an overclocker, me talking about benchmark relevancy is kind of a misnomer. But in the mobile space, I think that is actually a legitimate discussion.
Well, I know that the buzz seems to be to move the screens into the HD space. And I remember when we thought, well, when phones hit 720, that'll be good enough. And now 1080p seems to be the benchmark. And of course, with the Retina display and whatever marketing madness is out there, people are talking about, is that good enough? And realistically, I wonder if when we're talking about a 4-inch or 5-inch or, gosh, a 6-inch in some of the bigger devices, I mean, how much is too much? I mean, do we really shop based on specs in a phone? Or are we really birds of a feather in that, you know, you just go in and get whatever the best phone is when it's upgrade time?
And I think that the U.S. mentality is to just buy the best phone that, you know, kind of like what I did, buy the best phone that's available.
Well, I agree. And what's interesting is the parallel in nearly everything else is not there. The mentality behind it doesn't make sense. I mean, when we talk about PCs, even on our site, which caters to the enthusiast crowd, we talk about, okay, well, is it good enough? I mean, what's the lowest that you can get that's going to be good enough for games? It's going to be good enough for benchmarking. You're not going to be out buying that extreme processor and that hot motherboard necessarily every time. It's nice if you can afford it, but we're not all packing for Titans and an extreme processor. It's just not realistic. But for some reason, we all think that we need to go out and get whatever that top phone is, whether we like it or not. And let's face it, your Angry Birds is going to play probably anyway.
Right. And you got to also think about what are the drawbacks of buying that latest and greatest phone.
Power.
My S4, I was running the navigation app, which admittedly is hooked into Google Maps. It works really, really well.
Sure. Sure. And the GPS, right?
And the GPS. I had that thing running. We were going to a restaurant. I know exactly where it is. I don't necessarily need to have the navigation working, but I wanted to see how well it worked.
Okay.
And which store it would send me to. It sent me to the wrong one, the one I wasn't really going to, but that's another story. So by the time we got to the restaurant, I picked up my phone and it was almost too hot to handle. But yeah, the processor had heated up the entire device to the point where it was almost too hot to put in the pocket. I really wanted to put some ice on it or something. And that got me thinking, it's like, okay, all four cores are running full speed to give me navigation instructions. That seems dumb. Especially since, you know, the battery in these things only lasts a day if you actually use the device.
Yeah, and I think that's the big thing for me. When I switched to my Galaxy S3, I went from 2 days battery that I had in my Samsung Epic to, if I'm lucky, a single day. And that's not even under heavy use. I'm almost waiting for the next technology leap, whatever that ends up being. I just don't know where that's going to take us. It's interesting to see that the phone market and the phone technology is starting to parallel really the early days of PC development. We're starting to see different processors battling. We're starting to see dual core, multi-core, you know, higher bus speeds and stuff are starting to be things that we talk about in phones. The convergence is really happening, but the question really is, are we shopping for what we need? Are we shopping for what we want? Or are we just creatures of comfort and we buy the best phone available? I'm afraid that that's happening just a little too often.
Darren gets me to buy some of the strangest games.
Strange? These are great games.
Well, he introduced me to the Humble Bundle, and that was something that we talked about on the podcast. I finally bought into it.
It's a kind of a dangerous addiction between the, you know, the Kickstarters and all the different bundles. I'm starting to build really a pretty large backlog of new games. And yeah. I've always had kind of a large backlog of games.
Right. So what kind of games have you been playing lately?
Well, this week I'm actually pretty excited because one of the games that I Kickstarted when I very first started talking about Kickstarter, which seems like it's been over a year ago on the podcast, I Kickstarted a little tactical game that is called Takedown Red Saber, and it's been getting a lot of press. Was it E3? And it's a tactical shooter in the vein of the Ghost Recon style games, or the Tom Clancy games.
Oh, very nice.
What's interesting about the Takedown game, or Takedown Red Saber, other than the fact that, of course, it's just coming out, is that they've really done an amazing job of bringing back realism to the tactical shooter. Of course, the game really excels when you're playing with every member of your team as a human, but it has some really interesting things. In fact, I'd encourage you to go and look at some of the physics test videos that have been out, because they even go so far as to take into account the ballistic capabilities of the bullets and what the bullet penetration is like based on what type of material they're hitting. And that might sound a little too nerdy for you, but it's very, very much a squad-based tactical shooter.
So it just in terms of realism, it's how the game reacts as you're playing, not necessarily how enhanced the water graphics are.
Yeah, it's when I say realism, I mean getting killed means you're out until the mission is over.
Oh, no, not Counter-Strike.
And you, and you can actually be wounded, and you have to pick your loadouts and specialties and weight and, you know, ballistic armor affects speed and that sort of stuff. So in a way, it's almost like a first-person role-playing game in a sense.
I want to say that the original Quake, or maybe it was Quake 2, somebody released a mod that was like the real Quake or something like that. So if you got hit in the legs, you couldn't run this fast. And if you got hit in the arm, you would lose like half your health. And it was one of those games that annoyed the heck out of me because I wanted to play Quake the way that I learned how to play Quake. Right. And then when they enter these new game physics into it and no real way to qualify how the game determined that you got shot in the legs or that your red armor weighted you down or mm-hmm. something like that, you know, there was no way to qualify that except for the way that the game was designed. It really ruined Quake for me, at least in that sense.
Well, I think if the game isn't designed from the ground up to be that sort of game, it's always going to feel sort of tacked on. My problem with those sort of things is it feels like it takes an otherwise fairly quick game and just slows it down. And you really feel that speed change. So it's nice to see this one in action. And I have to confess that I'm very, very excited about it. But that's not even really the most interesting game that I've been playing lately. And that would probably be Prison Architect.
You know, you told me about that over lunch one day. And you said to go out to the website and watch some of the videos. And these two developers that are running the game studio, they created some really great videos to promote the game. And I'm not surprised that they got a lot of money off of Kickstarter for it.
So what's interesting about Prison Architect is that I didn't actually back it as a Kickstarter. In fact, I heard about it, and it was one of those that was kind of on my list. Part of the Kickstarter was that you could actually help write some of the backstory for the game. If you, and even that is true still today, although at a little bit higher dollar value than if you got in on the Kickstarter. So you can go right now and buy the game. It's in alpha, maybe beta, depending on really what you want to say about it. So it's very unfinished, but if you buy the base game, which is what I did, then you get the playable game in all its buggy glory, and it's kind of fun.
Yeah, they were joking about some of the bugs, and they were talking about, like, during a prison riot, you say, hey, you should be able to help this guard, but we haven't written those bits yet.
Most definitely, we'll have to pick a video or two from that huge series of entertaining videos and link it to the show notes. But Prison Architect is at heart a prison building sim, like Hotel Sim or Zoo Sim or even The Sims. But its primary thing is that you can build a prison and you control the guards and the gates and the whole nine yards. Now, I will warn you that it does have a dark streak to it. And some of that dark streak is provided by Kickstarters or people that invest in the alpha at a little bit higher level, what they call a deluxe or premium level, in that not only are you buying the game, but you are invited to contribute the name of a prisoner and the backstory. So you can come up with whatever crazy, weird, or gruesome backstory you have, and they'll insert it in there, and you can get that prisoner at random as one of the character prisoners in your prison that you've built. So kind of an interesting opportunity to immortalize yourself as some sort of random weirdo, or maybe your goal in life is just to be in prison for downloading too many MP3s. Anyway, you can participate, and if you give them enough money, yes, they'll even make that character look like you.
And that's actually something that you don't see from a game developing firm at all.
That's true. Partially because this was a Kickstarter, but also because of the way it's been marketed, you really are getting in pretty early. They're updating this thing at a pretty regular rate. So you do see dramatic improvement, but you're also seeing a lot of community-driven content and community-driven build. So it's your opportunity to get in and also influence what really the end game is going to be. So that's Prison Architect. If you're not even remotely interested in the game, you still owe it to yourself to go out and watch the promotional videos and the videos from the designer developers, because they're very, very entertaining. And you might also catch the bug to invest in this.
They got a lot of money off the Kickstarter, so I'm going to say that they're probably healthily spending that to build the game. So you might want to wait until it gets into beta and then buy into it.
Of course, by then, you'll be paying a full product price too. So it's an interesting point of thought.
Yep, flip a coin.
So that's Kickstarter for you. And I have to confess that when I invest in a video game on Kickstarter, I'm always impressed if it even just survives the development phase and comes out as a real product.
Or if it's just a video and that's all they want.
That's true. Buyer beware.
The Humble Bundle, you mentioned that. And I bought into it, and I'm not going to spoil the surprise, but they had a, I'm going to say, a title sort of bundle going on of 9 games.
It seems like almost there's a bundle saturation going on in the market that is exciting and frustrating at the same time, because I seem to be getting a new bundle announcement nearly daily these days. And there's a little bit of overlap, so you'll end up maybe with a few duplicate games, and that's fair because there are only so many developers that are participating. But every so often, you'll catch a really good one, and there have been a couple of really awesome ones lately. The one that you're talking about is a Humble Bundle that was driven by a game that I have a love-hate relationship with, and that's Killing Floor. Now, Killing Floor is at heart a, well, it's an arena survival game. So you have all of the player characters in the game, and they simply have to survive a wave of monsters, not unlike the zombies in Call of Duty or whatever, but it has a really unique flavor. So you might have, you know, clowns and a circus motif, or you might have Santa Claus and reindeer, or there's a Halloween theme, all these different things. And there are a lot of different skins. Now, Killing Floor has evolved to where it has some different mission-type scenarios in it. But realistically, what you're doing is not unlike Counter-Strike. If you survive the level, you get rewarded with money, and you can buy more ammo and upgraded weapons. And at the same time, you're leveling up your character so that you're stronger, better, faster. And that gives you a little bit of perseverance between gameplay sessions that isn't available in games that I normally like Team Fortress, for example.
All right. Recently, they had a really successful Humble Bundle.
So every so often, a really name-brand producer gets involved in the bundle business. The first one that really caught my attention was THQ. Now, THQ had a lot of financial issues, so they released, I mean, literally pretty much their entire catalog as bundles earlier this year.
Yeah, and that was like one of the first ones that really got the attention of people to the Humble Bundle.
That's true, and that was one of those bundles where everybody's like, well, this is just their last hurrah before they go out of business. And they actually managed to use that as a successful funding model to resurrect and get some of their titles out, which is why we're seeing the new Company of Heroes, for example. But most recently, we saw what we thought we'd never see, and that was an Origin-based bundle. That's right. EA released a bundle.
And that was the one that was 9 games.
Yeah, awesome.
And they gave you keys for Steam and for Origin, which is also unheard of.
Yeah, which is crazy. I mean, it's not uncommon to get Steam. I mean, that's kind of the distribution model du jour for the bundles, because you can do that. Is it the Desseria, or is the competitor Desidera, or whatever it is? I don't participate because I'm a big Steam fan, as you know. But the Origin bundle had almost their entire back catalog for the last year in it. So it had games like Mirror's Edge, for example, and Battlefield 3, for heaven's sakes.
And Crysis 2, the Maximum Edition, so it had all the DLC and stuff. And if you paid over the average, you got soundtracks, and you got...
Oh, and The Sims even had, a three-pack involved Sims and three of the expansions, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, and they made, what is it, over $10.5 million for charity on that one?
That's right, so... That's a really important dimension. So we've talked about bundles before, but if you're just catching up with the bundle system, most of the successful bundles, the Indie Gala bundle, the Humble Bundle, the distribution models behind these bundles are successful because they allow you to pay what you want. It's a little bit of a misnomer because usually there's a minimum range. For example, the trend seems to be a dollar minimum for whatever the bundle is to help pay for the Steam key system. There's also usually an incentive to spend more. As a nice example, like you said, the Humble Bundle, if you paid more than the average that was being spent, you got the Battlefield 3 and the Sims pack. Otherwise, you did not get those. So you had the option of really picking up those core games cheaply or spending just a few dollars more. In my case, I think I jumped in when the average was about $6 and get those extra games. Most bundles will add games as the sale progresses, and usually they don't announce them. So sometimes it's a pleasant surprise what shows up later in the bundle.
Right. And I think I put in $10. I paid a little bit more than the average, mm-hmm. which was good. They gave you an option for four different charities to donate your money to. Plus they wanted a buck and a half just to run the Humble Bundle site. Tip us this amount for, running the thing. And I really like that kind of model. You know, the company hosting it should get some money because they don't have any advertisements on there. And
right.
EA is not going to actually pay to go and give away their games. Although I think they're going to take the $10.5 million that they made from it in pseudo money and write it off on their taxes saying, hey, we gave this as a donation.
I'm sure that's the case, and that helps drive the sales. Usually you see a little bit older games out there, so it's a great opportunity to pick up games that you maybe passed up or had a little less interest in when they were still $39 or $49, but for a couple of bucks, you'll give them a go. And it's a nice way to back up your library. And the $10.5 million for charity just is icing on the cake. I would buy a lot of games that I would normally pass on if I know that a big chunk of that money is going to a pretty good charity. So in that case, they're very successful. Now, we've talked a lot about what I've been playing and how I've been purchasing games and really what's become an impressive backlog of games I may never get to. But I know you have also been online and playing lately with the new Borderlands 2 downloadable content.
Yeah, I don't have the same free time that you do. So yeah, I've been putting a little bit of time into the Borderlands, and I've been following the DLC development quite closely because once again, they raised the level cap.
Yes.
So now you can get up to level 72. With the DLC, with the level cap, they gave you a new area called Digistruck Peak. And it's basically it's kind of like an arena where you enter the arena and then they spawn enemies for you. So the first section might be the skags. And then the next section, you have these little midget guys running after you.
Now, I've played the DLC, though arguably only a couple of times. If I'm not mistaken, it's presented like it's sort of a training level, right?
Yeah.
Is it Scarlet that's the...
No, it's Tannis.
Tannis, that's right. Tannis, who tells you this is basically a training area.
Yeah, and she's using you as a guinea pig to determine what she needs to change. If you follow the story the way that it's supposed to be, every time you run through the training area, it's supposed to change the area for you. But there's a clevet in that you pass through three times, I think, and then it unlocks the ability to overlevel. But you have to be at level 72 to overlevel.
Oh, that's right, yeah. So in effect, if you're not level 72, it gets pretty old.
Yeah, because I ran through, I want to say 9 or 10 times just because it was easy. It was one of those things where once you know where the monsters are going to spawn, you can stand in a certain area and be far enough away that you can kind of pick them off at a distance. Or, I play as a siren so I can phase lock them and bring everybody in and throw in a grenade and I'd be on my way. Of those 9 times or 10 times that I've played, I've only gone up 4 levels. And with my particular character, I hadn't gone through and finished the ultimate Vault Hunter mode yet. So I went and fought the warrior again, and I think I went up 2 levels when I finished that portion of the game and then went back and started playing Digistruck again. At this point, I can either use the Gibbed save editor, which is one of those fun things to play with and really enhances the game to the point where it makes it fun to play instead of like a grind.
Now that's a combination right between a character editor and I guess sort of a trainer of sorts, right? Because you can sync your character and your level and your equipment, even your experience points to whatever is appropriate for the area you're in, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes. Like, for instance, if I have a shotgun that I found at level 30 and I want to use it with my level 50 character, I can just give that equipment to that character and then sync it with my level. So it will up it to level 50 and up the stats. And then at that point, I can change like the components on the weapon so I can make it apply more damage or be faster or have faster reload, or you can tailor it at that point. So you can kind of tweak anything in the game that you would normally get.
Well, and I know that that tool's caught in a bit of a bad rap because you can also create unrealistic equipment that can't exist in the game.
Right.
And, but at least it keeps it interesting.
Yeah, and Gearbox has gone through and painstakingly tried to make sure that the gibbed weapons can't exist. So if you create something that's not supposed to exist, it will remove it from your inventory. It protects people from, you know, you join a game and you get a weapon from somebody and it turns out it's not going to be a legitimate one and they don't want you to have that for obvious reasons.
Right.
With this latest DLC, they went and removed some of the glitches in the game because you could glitch your way into the treasure room after you've completed the Scarlet's DLC. And then they changed the weapon thing. They also made the overlevels, which is a really interesting take on playing the game the way that you would if you modified everything. So I believe Master Kiz commented saying that it's more of a gibbed peak instead of a digistruct peak.
That's kind of interesting.
So for instance, it's like if you wanted to play overlevel 3, you can run overlevel gear. So you're still a level 72 character, but you're fighting monsters that are 3 levels above you. Some of the bosses are actually already 2 levels above, so now they're 5 levels above.
Now, and to be fair, as the creatures get stronger, they become a bit of a bullet sponge.
Yeah, so they resist damage is what they do.
Yeah, and that's kind of important to note because, it's almost kind of cheating by the developers because rather than come up with newer, stronger creatures, they just give them more resistance, bigger shields, and more life points so that they, you honestly have to hammer them to kill them. But otherwise, they're very similar to the same characters you've been fighting all along and the creatures that have been spawning as the game progresses. So in that, I'm a little disappointed, and that is one of the major outcries, actually, about the latest downloadable content. That and the fact, of course, that it was not included in the season pass.
Right. Yeah, you had to pay, $6? It's not really a lot, but you had to actually pay for it. And if you didn't buy the previous level enhancement, you couldn't get up to level 72. You'd get Digistruct Peak, but you would top out at level 61, so you couldn't do the overlevels. So they made you buy both of the DLCs to raise the level cap. At over level 8, the monsters are almost like level 100, and they have so much damage resistance that you have to modify your weapons to be able to get past them, or you have to go in with a group of 4 with similar gear. So it makes it to the point where you either have to play the game and grind through the almost nonstop, and at that point it's like, you know, how many times can you go and complete the main storyline before it gets boring, right?
Oh, geez, tell me.
It's kind of the same thing. How many times can you go through the Digistruct Peak? It gets old after a while. They say that if you're at over level 8 and actually complete it, the last boss is guaranteed to drop a pearl, which is like one of the super rare weapons.
Oh, that's true. And that was introduced in the DLC too, that new weapon type. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, they added the pearl weapons, and they also added new pearl weapon types in this particular DLC, but again, you still have to go up to level 72, then go through 8 more times to unlock over level 8, then have good enough gear to make it through, because if you get all the way through and don't complete it, you have to start over at the very beginning, so it becomes even more of a grind.
Well, I'm not sure that sounds as fun as I would expect.
I'm not a fan. I've gotten to the point where I planned to legitimately get my Siren, my character I play, up to level 72, maybe do an overlevel, and then I was going to modify some of my other characters to get them up there so I could play multiple characters in the area. But after going through like 8 or 9 times and not getting the experience that I need to, and having monsters that are already 2 levels above me, even though I'm not to 72 yet, it's taking longer and longer to the point where I don't see a point.
Well, it definitely feels like they've introduced sort of an artificial break to the machine. And it's really kind of, I think, marketed to the hardcore folks that are really just coming back to the game for a challenge. But the side effect is the DLC, the tower, the DigiPeak itself, feels very short and very small. It's really kind of introduced yet an additional grind without any really new monster types, very little additional story. So you're paying, in a sense, just for the ability to do this over-leveling and the new level cap. The level itself is more of an afterthought. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, I would say that that is a very fair assessment. And what's really sad about it is that Randy, you know, CEO of Gearbox, has already said that there's going to be more DLC for Borderlands 2. And I believe part of that is because of the response of the game. A lot of people bought the game, mm-hmm. and they bought the season pass and all the DLC. And that's, at that point, they spent about $100 to buy this game. And it's arguably a $40 game, $30 game, buy it on sale for $7.
Right. I think we'd both agree that the game itself is a must buy. I would have no problem recommending the season pass, but you can also purchase skins and heads and stuff too, which I've never been a fan of. I think Team Fortress 2 really is the model that does that right.
Right. I believe that they've had too much success with the game and they're feeling forced into putting out more DLCs. And I think that's the reason that we're seeing half-assed Digistruck Peaks being brought out and another DLC, which will probably be a very similar sort of situation. It's not going to be a new storyline. It's not going to be like another Captain Scarlet's Pirate Booty sort of DLC, which is actually a really fun one.
Right.
You know, the Mr. Torgs, I played through that one just for the fun of it, and I got through and I knew where to go and what to do, so I got through in 2.5 hours, I think. You know, they're relatively short, but they had a bunch of side missions that really extended it.
But also the good news on those was you got new enemy types too, which right. we didn't see in DigiPeak. And I think that the whole game is really crying for new bad guys that are higher level challenges. I mean, not just repeated stronger versions of the others. And we did see that a little bit with the Tiny Tina expansion.
Yeah, Tiny Tina was, I want to say it was the best DLC out of the group that you could download for the season pass.
I think I would agree with you. Very original, creative, fun, and a throwback, you know, even in a loving, if not silly, homage to a lot of games that I think we all have grown up with.
Yeah, I really liked the DLC in terms of what it brought, and it also, you know, you had the it changed from a money-based system to an iridium-based system. So opening up a weapons chest, you could roll the dice by paying more iridium, and you could get a chance to better weapons. It also unlocked, like if you rolled a 20, it would unlock an achievement and give you more badass points that also tweaked your character to give them more damage or whatever. Those aspects of it, and the fact that they exposed the underlying mechanics that you would see in the original games, like you open up a weapons chest, it's like rolling a dice, what's going to be in here? Well, now you get to see it. And I really like that aspect of it. And in terms of the DLC itself, it was a lot longer than, you know, like even Captain Scarlet, which was actually pretty long itself.
Well, the storylines were interesting, new bad guy types. And I found that even at level 60, unless you're pretty optimized in your build, it was challenging, but not, you know, frustratingly so.
Yeah. And part of the challenge that I noticed was the fact that you would have waves of monsters instead of just going into an area and having whatever you'd see. For instance, when you go into the Caustic Caverns, the first enemy you run into is a Varkid, which are these little bugs, for instance. And you would have a set amount of Varkids coming through. Well, in the Tiny Tina expansion, you would have waves of orcs. And then once you cleared out those orcs, you would have another wave of orcs. And that was really the challenge, because at this point you're spewing bullets everywhere and you're just trying to stay alive. And if you stayed far enough back, it was survivable. But if you was a gung-ho sort of character, like if you're playing
the Berserker?
Yeah, Krieg. You know, you'd have to go in there and melee your way through. And that's not really going to be an area that would work well for that character.
I think one of the other things that is important to note is we've talked before about, you know, how there is a synergy aspect to the game where you can get abilities that help other players that are playing in your party. and how that's so underutilized. And I think that there is a lot more that encourages that, starting with the Tiny Tina, because really a more well-rounded group where you have several of the classes represented is going to do better than singles. I think we all tried to play, you know, one character or two characters because the new character classes come out, and you find that you've got, you know, four Kriegs in the server together, and you do all right in the regular content. But in at least the Tiny Tinas, you feel that lack of roundedness in the party.
Right. And that's really a throwback to what they were trying to go after, which is a tabletop gaming. You know, this is like a Dungeons and Dragons throwback, a role-playing game. As you and I both know, you need to have like a mage, you need to have an archer, you need to have a rogue, you need to have different character types, because you run into an area, one character is going to dominate that area and help pull you through. And that's what you have with the Tiny Tina adventure. Unfortunately, that's really lost in the Digistruck peak. I'm a little disappointed, but I bought it and I'm telling you about it. And I would say, if you are looking for a game that's going to net you probably about 200 hours of fun.
Especially with your friends.
Yeah, Borderlands 2 is going to be the one for you.
Well, we've talked about a lot of different games in this segment. We got Tactical in the Takedown. We got a Sim in Prison Architect. You got really arena combat in a more traditional sense in Killing Floor. You know, you can't go wrong with Origin. And as you know, we love Borderlands 2. I just wish it didn't feel like they were phoning it in sometime. So hopefully there's something in there that you like. But if we've missed a game you love, as always, let us know in the forums at ninjalane.com.
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes. If you have questions, drop by the forums or email us at podcast@ninjalane.com. Stay up to date on the latest at Ninja Lane by subscribing to our RSS, now available on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2013. Thanks for listening.